Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why do people remain in refugee camps for decades? Refugees remain in camps for an average of 17 years, and often for much, much longer, according to our next guest. Elizabeth Dunn is a professor of geography at Indiana University, and she explored this phenomenon for her latest book, No Way Home.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you, Elizabeth Dunn. This book is extraordinary. I can't believe you spent 16 months in refugee camps. How did you decide to do this? And how did you decide how to do this?
So I don't think anybody chooses to go to a refugee camp. I think that it's one of those things that happen to you like it happens to the people who live there. And I actually had a Fulbright scholarship to go to Georgia. And before this, I was a scholar of food and agriculture. And I was working with apple farmers in a region called South Ossetia, which was then a province of the Republic of Georgia. And I had come to learn Georgian. I'd come to Indiana University to learn Georgian. And I had, you know, rented my house. I'd sold my car. I had my five-year-old with me. We're literally driving to the airport when I get a call from the State Department saying, don't get on the plane. The Russians have invaded. They have bombed the airport.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was quite shocking. So I ended up turning back to Colorado and teaching for a semester. And that was August the 8th, 2008. And so by the time I arrived on New Year's Day or thereabouts in 2009, there were 36,000 people who had been more or less permanently displaced. The number of permanently displaced ended up to be about 30,000 people. And the Georgian government had started building these little settlements for them. They called them settlements because in distinction to an earlier population of displaced people who had lived for 17 years in old in-tourist hotels, the government was telling the people who had been displaced in 2008 that this was likely to be a permanent condition. And so had moved them into these, I don't know, they really feel like camps. They called them settlements, but they feel like camps. So row after row after row of little white cinder block houses that looked, for all intents and purposes, like every refugee camp you've ever seen.
You noted in the introduction of the book, which is called No Path Home, that there were something like, by 2016, 65 million people forced from their homes. Now, if people think about this, the population of California is 39 million people. We're talking about 65 million people by 2016. I assume that number has grown in 2017.
Oh, yeah. There have been 275,000 people, this time in Burma, displaced in the last 7 days, right? So this is not a problem that is going away. It is a problem that is going to be exacerbated by climate change, by conflicts. Now that there is like no bipolar stabilization from the Cold War, now that the U.S. does not act effectively as a hegemon, we are going to see flare-ups of these little wars all over the world. And the upshot is that the number of displaced people around the world is just escalating dramatically. When I started the research for this book in 2009, there were 35 million displaced people. And we've almost doubled that number in under a decade. So this is a huge ongoing problem. And while the Syrians, of course, have gotten all the attention because of their flight towards Europe, the truth is that two-thirds of the displaced people in the world never leave their countries of origin. They're internally displaced people. And they're getting no attention. They're getting very little help. And I think that their situation will become more dire.
You described this in your book as having a protection gap. There's a protection gap between the internally displaced and the people who are external refugees. What exactly is this?
Well, I think the question of who is supposed to protect internally displaced people is an open question. Internally displaced people do not formally fall under the United Nations mandate under the 1951 Convention on Refugees, although they've been called persons of interest to the High Commission on Refugees. So the upshot upshot is that they are still the responsibility of the government of their country of origin. And the problem is that many, many times that is the government that forced them from their homes. So we're leaving them at the mercy. I mean, the responsibility to protect them is given to the people who were their aggressors. That's a really big protection gap. I mean, we're seeing this week with the Rohingya, right, who are nominally the responsibility of the Burmese government. They are Burmese citizens. Burma has decided they don't count as Burmese citizens and is forcing them across the border into Bangladesh. So can we really say that this is the protecting these people should be the business of the Burmese government? I mean, that makes no sense at all. So nobody protects these people in many cases. There is no protection for them at all.
You also noted that they end up staying in these camps for decades sometimes, at least a decade and a half in many instances.
Yeah. Once a person enters a camp, and today it's less than half the people who are displaced will go to a camp. And we talk about why they are refusing to enter camps. But once a person enters a camp, the average length of stay is 17 years. And the record length of stay is over 70 years.
Wow.
That's Palestinians. So that's now almost three generations born in what is supposed to be a temporary situation. So thinking of displacement as a temporary condition and providing temporary emergency aid, like a tent, for example, is crazy. This is not a temporary condition. It is a permanent condition of statelessness or quasi-statelessness.
Now, you also wrote about what actually happens to people in these conditions. And, you know, some of it is, the way you described it is, yes, they're still alive, their hearts are beating, their lungs are breathing, but they're not really living. And there's two kind of senses going on in terms of security and in terms of being part of a community. All of that is destroyed. How would you help us understand that?
Yeah, I think that the problem of forced migration has been thought of in two ways, usually. One is legally. What are these people's legal rights in their country of origin? What are their rights if they are forced out of their country of origin? Do they have any rights to migrate to another country? And the second way, and I think the much more frequent way that displacement is thought of, is as a problem of material goods, as a logistics problem, right? So the problem is to replace all the cots and pots and beds and pans that they had before. And once they get some replacement for those things, then their problem is solved. And I don't think that that either of these are the real problem of displacement. The real problem of displacement is what I think of as an ontological one or an existential one, which is to say that, you know, most of us go through the world being fairly able to predict what's going to happen from day to day. And the things in our world are connected to each other in ways that make sense. I mean, you know, on a given, when you walk into your house, what your house is going to look like. You know where food is coming from. You know if you walk into a bureaucrat's office, more or less what's likely to happen. So it's not perfectly predictable, but our lives are fairly predictable. And for a displaced person, especially in the initial years, several years of displacement, the world makes no sense at all, right? Everything in their world has been literally blown apart. And that means all the relationships among things have been blown apart. And all of a sudden, this whole reign of new ideas, new terms, new things, new people are coming in that are brought in by the humanitarian project. And it's a profoundly disorienting process. And I have now spent time with displaced people in the Republic of Georgia, where I did field work. I also am on the board of a resettlement agency here in Indiana, and I pick people up at the airport when they're first arriving. And it's amazing that it's the same experience, whether they're from Congo or Syria or Georgia, which is that they're stunned into speechlessness, sometimes for weeks. I mean, that they literally will sit there with blank, expressionless faces saying nothing 24 hours because the whole world has gone haywire. The whole world has been fragmented for them. And so my book is really about how people negotiate that experience of fragmentation, and while being trapped in this state of being permanently temporary, try to make a stable and meaningful world around themselves.
The other part that your book is about how humanitarian aid workers and organizations are really well-meaning, but there's this problem of perpetuation of people in these camps and not giving whatever it is they need to be able to reestablish themselves in a community.
Yeah. And so the book makes a very strong argument, which is that humanitarian aid not only does not help displaced people deal with the enormous existential disorientation of displacement, but actually works against them creating stable and meaningful lives for themselves. That's a pretty strong accusation, actually. And many humanitarians I have made this argument to are really upset about it. Needless to say, but I'll tell you, there's a couple of reasons why this happens. One is that humanitarian aid, because of the way it's organized, which is to say not very well organized, really creates an enormous amount of inconsistency and uncertainty. So in a given humanitarian emergency, the one that I was involved in the Republic of Georgia was very small. The war was only 5 days. We're only talking about a population of about 30,000. We had 96, I think, or 94 different aid agencies, government funders, UN agencies, ministry officials, 90 some odd different organizations all running around trying to coordinate with each other. When you look at something like the Haitian earthquake of 2010, you're not talking about 100 organizations. You're talking about 1,000 organizations, each of which is doing its own thing, none of which is controlled by a central planner. They coordinate with each other badly, if at all. The United Nations has a system for interagency coordination called the cluster system. And I always say it's a cluster something. System is not the word I would use. And literally they cannot coordinate the work. So what you get is, on the one hand, duplication of efforts or the delivery of aid that's radically inappropriate. With the population I was, they came streaming in with programs for children, but this population, because it had been affected by the collapse of the Soviet Union, most of the young people had left in search of work. And so it was a disproportionately elderly population. So they were getting, you know, toys and child-friendly spaces, and the people who were suffering were over 50. So you're getting inappropriate aid, you're getting duplication of aid, and you're getting huge gaps in aid. So one village gets cell phones, the next village gets nothing. One village gets plumbing, the next settlement gets nothing, or they get outhouses, or they expect someone to arrive and help them do something about sanitation, and they wait and they wait and they wait, and they're just on the cusp of doing something themselves when then an aid agency comes. So the aid agencies, because they're organizing around the project, they are doing a very bad job at letting displaced people know in a timely fashion what will happen to them. And once that kind of uncertainty has been introduced into the process, it's really hard for displaced people to use their own resources or coordinate their own efforts, because the minute they do so, the aid agencies rush in and mess everything up again. You know, one really good example of that was in a village I worked in called Hurvaletti. And it was one of the camps. And in Hurvaletti, they were waiting and waiting and waiting to find out if they would get plumbing. They didn't have running water. So they had these cinder block houses and no running water. So finally, everybody says, well, you know, we're going to have to grow food anyway. So they planted gardens in their yards, which is where their outhouses were. And then, of course, because they put pit outhouses into clay soil, which doesn't drain, the sewage came up and over, contaminating the food supply. And to come in and pump those outhouses out, you would have to destroy the gardens. Right? So it's this kind of thing that's happening all the time for displaced people, and it makes it simply impossible for them to get their feet underneath them and make any kind of plans for the future. And so they just sit in this eternal present, right? I mean, it's like Groundhog Day. If you can imagine Groundhog Day going on for 17 years.
You analyze this a little bit through the idea of the normal situation, right, that was shattered.
Yeah, and that's a technical term taken from the philosophy of Alain Badiou, who talks about the normal situation not as being a situation which is particularly peaceful or particularly violent or particularly any one way or another, but a situation in which most of the things in your daily experience are networked together in a stable arrangement. And this is the one thing that we constantly deprive displaced people of, the ability to know from day to day, more or less, what's going to happen. And that predictability, whether the situation that is built for them is productive and good or shitty and violent, if it's either one of those things, good or bad, it's at least predictable and you can act. But if it's constantly unstable, you're paralyzed. You sit there, I'm serious, for years, barely able to speak.
One of the other conclusions that you made with this book was that the systemic failure exposes a second goal. So their first goal, which is, you know, some kind of humanitarian aid, like keeping people alive, being useful, being helpful. And to some degree, they are. They're keeping people alive. But you said there's another goal, which is really protecting donor countries from the displaced.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that with the advent of the war in Syria, that it's become the overwhelming goal, which is to keep people trapped in both space and time, in order to prevent them from moving towards donor countries. And so what we're looking at is not a strategy that is what it claims to be, which is, according to the aid agencies, and especially UNHCR, about social reintegration. It's not about social reintegration. It's literally about offshoring people and keeping them distinct from the society that they've landed in, so that they cannot move towards the donor countries. So we're thinking that we can somehow put displaced people on ice by putting them in camps or holding them now in countries which have been, whole countries which have been turned into camps. Like Greece is a giant camp now. And we have this idea that offshoring is somehow a resolution to the problem. If only we can keep all the Syrians in Turkey. If only we could keep all the Sudanese in the Dadaab camp in Kenya and prevent them from moving towards Nairobi. That this is a solution. And I think one of the biggest arguments of the book, something I would argue passionately, is that this is not a solution at all. It's not a solution for displaced people. I mean, being held in limbo for decades, but it's not really a long-term solution for donor countries, because camps, when people are held in situations like this, this is how we find people becoming radicalized, becoming frustrated and angry and willing to sign on to any program that will promise them some movement forward.
You also suggested in the solution side that really we have to look at geopolitics.
Yeah, I think one of the very strange things about writing this book is that everyone asks me for solutions. There's something about the whole construction of a humanitarian project which demands solutions. And by that, I don't mean resolutions of the problem. I mean, they want technocratic solutions within the framework of an aid project. And the problems that we face now are not resolvable through humanitarian projects. The real issue is coming up with a new and better way of stabilizing conflict so that people aren't displaced in the first place. And or making peace so that they can go home and get back to their real lives or rebuild new lives once they've been returned. But the end resolution of the Syrian crisis is not to have better services in camps. The end resolution of the Syrian crisis is for the United States and Iran and Russia to stop fomenting war in Syria. That and so I think when we think of this as a technocratic problem of aid, that is a deliberate attempt to move our gaze away from the root cause. And so I know that it is simplistic to say, well, let's not have war. It is idealistic to say, let's have some kinds of international agreements around displacement and the management of displacement and displacement as a technique of war. That I know that is idealistic, and yet it is the only long-term stable resolution for this problem. And if you don't like that answer, then you should plan on another 100 million people being on the move in the next decade.
You know, it sounded like some of the people you interviewed actually said this as well.
Yeah, I think that it was very interesting to me that although most of the aid workers I talked to in Georgia were very focused on technocratic solutions within the framework of aid, the IDPs themselves that I spent a lot of time with were acutely aware that this was a geopolitical project, a geopolitical problem that could only be resolved geopolitically. And so they would, for example, they'd be offered, you know, women's peace building classes. And the women would say to me, like, what the hell do I need a peace building class for? I didn't start this war. Why don't you send Bush and Putin to a peace building class? And, you know, they were, in fact, correct, right? That this had been a war in Georgia between a U.S.-backed regime, the Saakashvili regime in Georgia, and a Russian-backed regime in South Ossetia. And that it was a crisis of regional and even global geopolitics that had almost nothing to do with them. So any intervention you're targeting at them is a misplaced intervention. And they knew that better than anybody. In fact, the most astute analyses of the problem at the level of global geopolitics I got were from IDPs themselves, who had lots and lots of time to watch the news.
The last thing I wanted you to respond to was that people were actually suffering more after the conflict than actually during the conflict. How can that be?
We tend to think about physical suffering in conflict as being related to the violence of war, right? So when you talk to Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, they are really good at dealing with gunshot wounds and machete hacking. There are many, many NGOs that come in to provide prostheses. I don't know why prostheses is the medical intervention of choice, but it often is. And so they're very good at acute care. But displacement is a chronic condition. So what happens to people is that the erosion of their health is happening in slow motion over a long period of time, and they're not receiving the kinds of medical treatment they need for chronic conditions related to displacement. So, for example, I will tell you that if you're on a World Food Program food package, most of the calories you are getting are from white carbohydrates, white rice, white bread, sugar. They get, you know, big quantities of sugar because those things are easy to move in and because it's a cheap way of meeting caloric goals. Okay, you know, if your displacement is 3 weeks, you're going to survive living on nothing but macaroni for 3 weeks. But the people I was with lived on 3 servings of macaroni a day, every day for almost 2 years. And not surprisingly, diabetes became a big problem. And many of the people I knew were struggling with to stabilize themselves because they had become diabetic. People who had been diabetic before were dying of their disease because they couldn't get enough treatment for it, and they certainly couldn't start to have a healthier diet. And yet there was no sort of recognition that medical care for displacement should involve the improvement of diet, right? Or should involve medication for hypertension, which was a big one where I was. Hypertension was not seen as a war-related condition, and yet is intrinsically a war-related condition for many of these people who are living under tremendous stress and who are not receiving anti-hypertensive drugs and can't afford to buy them themselves because they've lost their jobs, they've lost their land, they've lost their livelihoods. And so my friends were dying of strokes. And it was, you know, I followed the same group for almost 8 years. And it got to the point where every year I'd go back and I spent my whole summer at funeral after funeral after funeral. The rate at which people were dying was fantastic. And yet that was not conceived of as a war-related condition.
Well, Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, it has been a great pleasure to talk with you about this book, No Path Home. Really fascinating read, fascinating research. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
I am so excited. Thank you so much.